and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, May 10th, 2024. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. Asian Heritage Month in Canada, and this month we're very excited to bring you a two-part discussion on the history of Asian labor in Canada. This week's episode is a continuation from last week's conversation, in which Rabble Labor reporter Kia Lucera and Patricia Chong and Corrine Ng from the Ontario and BC branches of the Asian Canadian Labor Alliance discussed the history of the alliance, key moments of Asian labor in Canada, and how racism, systemic discrimination, and othering still shows up in Canada today. Today we continue that conversation and dig into the concept of a model minority, what it means to be an immigrant on stolen land, and how all racial justice fights are intertwined. A little bit about our guests. Patricia Chong holds an MA in Labor Studies from McMaster University and a Master's in Labor Policies and Globalization from the Global Labor University in Germany. She is a short documentary filmmaker and a member of the Asian Canadian Labor Alliance Ontario chapter. Corrine Ng is an immigrant settler on Turtle Island whose work is anchored in education spanning across diverse ages and socio-cultural settings in the ancestral lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people and elsewhere. The Asian Canadian Labor Alliance is a national organization that represents the voices of Asian Canadian trade union members, Asian Canadian workers, and the Asian community at large. In our last conversation, we left off with Corrine's point on how geopolitical tensions of today, along with social media, often make Asian populations the scapegoat for hate and vitriol online. Let's jump back in.
The one last thing that I will add is, you know, kind of comparing the past to the present is the geopolitical tensions. I'm definitely noticing that. And also, of course, technology, social media, and the discourse that happens on there. You know, I really notice that it is impacting perceptions and sort of, you know, like social media can, you know, act as a echo chamber and, you know, that kind of, you know, like toxic rhetoric being circulated really quickly. And so like how racism shows up is very interesting. It's really changing the landscape. But again, the root is the same. Like the manifestations may look different, but the root is the same. But there's definitely a latent danger there just because the power of social media and how the quickness and fastness of like how information travels and how it can just influence large swaths of people, you know, with algorithms and things like that. And I'm just finding that with the geopolitical tension, right, between different countries, you know, like namely, you know, the tension between China and the US and also with Canada, India, you know, those are just some examples of how, you know, I'm seeing, you know, sometimes we're scapegoated for really things that we're not responsible for as individuals, and the regimes get confounded with the people.
Could we kind of like expand a little bit more on that and how we're being scapegoated or how like Asian Canadians are being scapegoated into that? Because I do like the perspective of like looking at the intersectionality of everything and looking at everything from an anti-oppression lens. Can we kind of expand on that topic a little bit?
So in addressing an intersectional approach in confronting anti-Asian racism and how it links to other forms of oppression, I think Carol Wall, who passed away about a year ago, was a great advocate involved with the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. And she spoke at the Toronto Solidarity Rally against anti-Asian racism in 2021. So this was in the peak of COVID. And she said this to the crowd. She said, "We end anti-Asian racism when we abolish white supremacy. We end anti-Indigenous racism when we abolish white supremacy. we end anti-Black racism when we abolish white supremacy. And she identified herself as an abolitionist because she believed the abolitionist project is not finished, was not finished, and we needed to take up actions against that and identify as abolitionists. And so the idea specifically with anti-Asian racism was trying to find a way to address anti-Asian racism within a bigger context of white supremacy. And I think that's what Carol Wall was getting at in terms of that quote. And this idea that how do we go from, as Karine mentioned, 1907, where the Vancouver Labour Council is actively campaigning for a riot, where we were once seen as a threat, as unclean, as more, you know, opium dens, threats to morality, threat to the thread of Canada. How do we go from that in 1907 to being considered a quote-unquote model minority in a very quick amount of time? It's actually quite fascinating to think of those that character changing over time. And I think one of the reasons this has been able to happen is that with Blacks being freed as slaves, as being emancipated, technically speaking, with Indigenous people being quote-unquote granted the same rights as everyone else, you have, again, white supremacy moving the chess pieces on the chessboard in order to uphold white supremacy. And the role that Asians, and I say Asians broadly, you can't see my quotation marks, but my Asians broadly, is that we play the model minority role. And the idea, and people, you're nodding your heads, the idea is that we were held up as, and continue to be held up as, a model, in the sense that if you were industrious enough, if you worked hard enough, if you were quote unquote smart enough, you could succeed in the Canadian dream, in the American dream, and have class mobilization. However, as quote-unquote Asians were held up as a model, which then means that if there's a model, there must be an opposite to the model, a failing, a moral failing, a working failing. And so Asians are upheld on one hand as a reason for success, while at the same time pushing down Indigenous people, Black people, by saying on the flip side, well, if only you worked harder, if only you were smarter, if only you were A, B, and C, you would have the upward social mobility that the Asians have. Of course, we know that's not true. Asians is not a hegemonic group. It's very varied, but that doesn't matter to this myth. And so unless you have this complete change, which I think is fascinating, and when I visited the Museum of Chinese History in the United States, they had a picture of the model minority, and the idea of that term being popularized in the United States in the 1960s, just as the American Civil Rights Movement is beginning to take hold. So you can see, again, white supremacy kind of, like I said, changing the pieces of the chessboard, so they're able to maintain it. And of course, as Asian people, we also have to question ourselves, at the expense of whom have we been able to rise, if at all? And also, in what ways have our parents, have our grandparents also accepted white supremacy, in the sense that, yeah, we're not white, we're close enough, at least we're not Black, at least we're not Indigenous. And then of course, the racial hierarchy there. And how do we play into that?
And I'm really happy you brought up the model minority myth, because I know that's something that is very entrenched in kind of Asian Canadian labor and just being Asian in general in Canada and so-called Canada. Karine, would you like to add anything to that?
This is great. Like, again, like, I don't want to repeat anything. I would only add that, you know, this participation in the settler colonial project of, you know, making of Canada and maintaining of colonial Canada. Like, another thing I think that we have to name, other than white supremacy, is capitalism, right? Like, you know, this model minority, at the root of it, is based on competition and a hierarchy, as Patricia mentioned. And all of that, right? Like, that's a blueprint of capitalism. We know that there is an inherent hypocrisy within capitalism, that, you know, as long as you work hard enough, it's as though we're equal to begin with, and we are in a competition. And we kind of accept those assumptions a lot of times without questioning, but are we equal to begin with, to start with? And do we believe in competition? So I think those are important questions to ponder, given that we are living and working and, you know, deriving our sustenance. We're breathing the air and, you know, walking on the land and drinking the water, you know, of Turtle Island, which, you know, has been stewarded and protected for us by folks here, you know, that have been here since time immemorial. You know, like, what are the ethical and moral implications of us being here and participating in this, you know, capitalist extractive and highly exploitative system that pits us against each other? So this model minority or scapegoating, it's all based on that model, right? And yeah, and I think, you know, like this idea that, you know, oh, it's human nature. That's just how it is. We're all in a rat race. I mean, are we? And I can think of many, like as an educator, right? I mean, looking at children, you know, if we were to talk about human nature, I mean, I can see many, many, many instances of how we can actually cooperate. And I just, as a society, we're giving our youth and ourselves enough options to think about, you know, like, and to actually enact, you know, a different way of being. And I think they're all, you know, speaking of, I think, Indigenous knowledge, is that we also have ancestral knowledges. You know, yes, we have a lot of also, you know, negative and toxic legacy, you know, because oppression is not, you know, unique, you know, to Europe. You know, like, it exists everywhere. There's patriarchy, you know, there's caste system, there's, you know, all types. So I think, you know, again, it's about looking into our history and drawing the strengths, you know. Where are the good teachings of our ancestors? You know, examples of how, you know, we have lived also, we've been able to live collectively. And it's usually not something that that was put in place by a regime top down. It's usually from the ground up. It's usually those who work the land, who are living in rural, like in close relationship with the land, who come up with those systems of cooperation and collaboration because they have to. And because, you know, they understand that they're also governed by not just human laws, but fundamentally by the laws of nature. And we can find that in our own history if we dig enough.
I want to ask you, what do you want people to keep in mind for Asian Heritage Month in relation to labor?
Well, actually, the first thought that comes to my mind is, you know, Asian heritage, just like any other heritage, doesn't just happen one month of the year. I mean, it's something that was all months, every day, you know, every day of our lives. And instead of seeing Asian heritage as something that only an Asian person has and holds, actually, it is just kind of circling back to what I had said earlier. You know, we're now part of this society. We're part of the fabric of this society. So it's actually all of our heritage. Like, I'll just start with that. But, and also the other, maybe the other piece to connect with labor is, you know, ultimately, you know, like labor, I really look at it in a really broad sense. It's not just about, you know, unionized labor or not, paid labor or not. It's all the labor that goes into sustaining, you know, our lives and the care that goes into, you know, like that goes into the, not just the sustaining of lives, but also of communities. What makes life worth living? You know, the community, the sense of, you know, belonging. You know, I'm thinking of childcare. I'm thinking of elderly care. I'm thinking of, you know, the growing and harvesting and processing of food. I'm thinking of, you know, the relation that we are constantly, you know, making and sometimes damaging, you know, through our work. There are those that do very concrete work that's analog, that's, you know, tilling the land, let's say, you know, or caring for a baby. And then there's work that is, you know, very virtual and kind of abstract. And just maybe think really deeply about who are the ones that are doing the work that truly build community, that keep us alive, that keep us happy and healthy and make our lives meaningful.
Thank you so much for that. Patricia, would you like to add anything to that?
Yes, building on Corinne's comments about capitalism, I think with Asian Heritage Month, it is good to think about what is our goal? What is it that we're actually fighting for? Are we fighting for a system of capitalism where Asians, let's just say we have a magical formula and we figure out that this type of Asian should own this percentage of wealth. Is that what we're fighting for? Does ACLA and any other anti-racist organization, are we fighting so we get a bit of the pie at the top? Or is it a bigger fight where we're saying, actually, we recognize we live in a capitalist society, racial capitalism at its core. We're not just talking about the liberation of quote-unquote Asian people. We're talking about the liberation of all people. And that fundamentally challenges capitalism at its core. There is no placating capitalism. There is no making nice with capitalism. Capitalism is inherently based on an exploitative system. You're at the top, you're at the bottom. And there's more people at the top than at the bottom. So I suppose when I wish people a happy Asian Heritage Month, I would like to have that type of slogan or thought in mind. And sometimes, and I will confess to you now that I don't like May's Asian Heritage Month, and then ACLA gets slammed with requests, particularly the last week of May, when people are like, oh no, it's the last week of May. I gotta organize something for Asian Heritage Month. And so I'm always like, I hate May. But maybe I would hate it less if, you know, we had that type of thought process. Like, I don't want to, like, be a president of some, like, random union where all they want to do is fight with the employer about A, B, and C's for their members. Like, that doesn't interest me. That isn't my passion. That might be someone else's passion. But, yeah, for me, a happy Asian Heritage Month, you know, maybe it's good because we've got May 1st, May Day. So maybe that could be a different way of framing Asian Heritage Month.
Absolutely.
If I can make a plug, there are a couple of publications that ACLA and BC have participated in. One is called Challenging Racist British Columbia, 150 Years and Counting. This is a project. We just participated in consultation. To be really honest, not a huge piece. This was written by a group of academics. They received a SHRC grant to do it, and we've been helping them promote. And it's a great pedagogical resource as well. So great for educators and students. If you could add a link to the write-up, that would be great. And the other piece is this has been just nominated for an award. My apologies, I can't remember the name of the award, but it's called White Riot, the 1907 anti-Asian riots in Vancouver. And there are pieces in there that really talk about the history of, you know, the various different Asian groups. And both publications are really great resources. So I would just make a plug. And the other two that are online, and for folks who are visiting Vancouver, the Chinese Canadian Museum in Chinatown, the Chinese Canadian Historical Society also publishes a lot of really good research. So something to check out online. But the museum is actually a brick and mortar museum. Bob Rennie, who is a real estate tycoon locally, owned that building for some time, and it is a very historical building. And, you know, kudos to those who managed to wrestle it out of his ownership. So now it's being held by a foundation and it's being turned into a museum. So I encourage folks, if they're in this neck of the woods, to go check it out. They do put on some really good shows.
Can I just add one example from the scrolls that actually talk about interracial solidarity? I'll be really quick. I'll just say from the ACLA banner scrolls, there is one portrait of the International Woodworkers of America based out in BC. And again, for decades, the Asian workers were always subject to inferior wages in comparison to the white Canadian workers, but the IWA in the 1940s started to demand the same wage treatment for all workers. So the IWA started hiring Chinese, Japanese, and South Asian organizers. And so we have Roy Ma, MAH, is the first Chinese IWA union staffer who organized more than 2,500 Chinese Canadians. Then we also have Joe Miyazawa, who also organized during his internment in a Japanese prison camp where he was a mill worker. And then we have Darshan Singh Sangha, who also organized many Sikh-dominated mills. And this was in the 1940s. So this is an example of cross-solidarity organizing.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank you again, Patricia and Kirin, for joining me on Ravel Radio.
All right. Thanks, Kia.
Thanks so much.
Was Patricia Chong and Kirin Ng from the Ontario and BC branches of the Asian Canadian Labour Alliance and Rabble's own labour reporter Kia Lucero. This was the second half of the conversation between these three, and if you missed the first half, you can find that episode on rabble.ca/podcast, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. For additional information, resources, and reading and watching materials mentioned in this interview, please review our show notes of this episode in your podcast app or on rabble.ca. Switching gears now, it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, we'll turn things over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news, a Rainbow Week of Action is being planned for next week from May 11th to the 17th to push back against rising levels of anti-2S LGBTQIA+ hate. Instances of hate and institutional discrimination against 2S LGBTQIA+ individuals has seen a marked increase over the past 2 years. Provinces like New Brunswick, Saskatchewan, and Alberta have all introduced anti-2S LGBTQIA+ policies over the past year, specifically targeting transgender youth. These policies require them to get parental permission to have their correct pronouns be used in schools and blocks them from receiving gender-affirming care. Federal Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre has likewise publicly made anti-trans statements. This is why a National Rainbow Week of Action is necessary, according to the Society for Queer Momentum, one of the organizers of Rainbow Week. Events will be held across the country during the week to pressure elected officials at all levels of government to provide better protection and support for 2S LGBTQIA+ individuals. Staying in national news, the president of the Canadian Labour Congress, Bea Brusque, is calling out the Federal Conservative Party for attempting to block a national pharmacare bill. Earlier this year, the NDP and their Labour allies celebrated as they were able to pressure the Liberal government to finally introduce a national pharmacare plan. The plan would cover contraceptive care for women and gender-diverse individuals up to $200 annually, and would also provide up to $1,500 a year to pay for insulin for those living with diabetes. The bill was set to be voted on in its second reading in the House of Commons this week, when the Conservatives put forward a motion to kill the bill. Brusque slammed the Conservatives for trying to stop this legislation, saying, quote, "The rights of Canadian women are too important to get caught up in partisan politics. Women across Canada are demanding that Pierre Poilievre stop blocking free birth control," end quote. The bill passed second reading with support from all parties in the House of Commons except the Conservatives, and will now go on to be reviewed by committee. In health news, this week is National Nurses Week. Rabble columnist Kathy Crowe shared stories from some of the nurses she knows that are doing the gritty work, not just in healthcare settings, but also as activists who are advocating for reforms. Crowe discusses nurses like Amy Archibald Varley and Sarah Fung, who also run the Gritty Nurses podcast, which discusses the challenges and difficulties nurses face as individuals and as a profession. Crowe explains how the work of these nurses on the ground is often left unsung, but has done a lot to improve healthcare in Canada. Crowe writes, quote, "Nursing has, of course, come a long way, primarily led by strong nursing union leaders such as Linda Silas of the Canadian Federation of Nurses Unions and her provincial and territorial counterparts," end quote. In feminist news, this week, PhD candidate Megan Timmits-Lamorand shared the history of Dr. Nikki Kolodny, a physician and activist who worked alongside Dr. Henry Morgenthaler to ensure women and gender-diverse people had access to safe abortions before they became legal in Canada. Timmits-Lamorand explains how Dr. Kolodny became involved in the pro-choice movement, how she was arrested in 1986 for administering safe abortions, and her reactions today to the growing anti-choice rhetoric from across North America. In environmental news, David Suzuki explains how corporate greed fuels environmental racism, both in Canada and the U.S. Corporate pollution is often overlooked when its harmful effects primarily impact communities of color. This is the case in Louisiana, where a primarily Black and Hispanic community situated in what is known as Cancer Alley due to that community's high exposure to levels of cancer-causing substances produced by corporations in the area. In Canada, look no further than Grassy Narrows, an Indigenous community in Ontario that has been suffering the effects of mercury poisoning caused by local industries for decades. Suzuki says that governments must do more to hold corporate polluters accountable. And finally, join us next week for Off the Hill as we talk about the myths and realities of Canada's labor shortage. When politicians and economists say Canada is facing a labor shortage, what does this mean and is this accurate? MP Matthew Green, economist Jim Stanford, president of the Ontario Federation of Labor Laura Walton, and Veronique Siufi, a researcher and policy analyst at the CCPA, will dissect all this and more on this month's Off the Hill panel, co-hosted by Robin Brown and Libby Davies. Don't miss out. Register to save your spot for this panel on Wednesday, May 15th at 4:30 p.m. Pacific, 7:30 p.m. Eastern. The link to register is in the show notes of this episode. To read the full version of all the stories we talked about today, please visit rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.